It's Thursday, the 21st of August, 2025. I'm Alec Hogg, and here is your Biz News Briefing. In today's episode, Black Billionaire Empowerment. Cape Independence is attracting interest from Washington. Peter Major identifies the tourniquet that is putting a stranglehold on South Africa's mining lifeblood. More from William Sanderson Mayer on why he believes South Africa is in a very dangerous place. And then gaming of the US work visas, news from South African companies, and a tailpiece with a singing dog. Well, that's to keep you informed and entertained over the next half hour or so. But let's kick off with Black Billionaire Empowerment. I spoke with Davie Ruert, one of our most astute economists and commentators, on Biz News TV yesterday. And one of the issues that he raised was something he dubs Black Billionaire Empowerment.
A black economic empowerment. I've been thinking about this, and I've been thinking about this word transformation. And you know what, Alec? I'm very, very much in favor of, listen to the literal meaning of the words black economic empowerment. I'm very much in favor of transforming the South African economy and the South African society. But in my book, what it means to transform and what it means to empower is different from what we are doing in South Africa. I think when you talk about BEE or transformation in South Africa, it means that you take from one group of people and you give to another group of people. Now, let's be honest about this. The idea behind BEE, or at least the way it's implemented in South Africa, transformation, is to take from white people and give to black people. But you don't give to all black people. You give it to a select group of black people. So actually what we have, we've got BBE, Black Billionaire Empowerment in South Africa, where the assets are transferred to a select group of individuals.
Is that a real thing, Davie? Is that a real thing? Because we know Professor Gumede said that R1 trillion had been given to 100 beneficiaries. Is it real? Was he exaggerating?
I haven't done the calculations myself. But if I look at our president, you know, if I look to President Ramaphosa, apparently he's worth something like 8 billion rand or something. I'm not sure what the number is. That's a number that I've picked up somewhere. And then I asked myself, if I talk about a very wealthy business person, and if you can talk, there are many other wealthy business people in South Africa. If you talk of Herman Mashaba, for example, De Vries, for example, many, many other wealthy people, and you ask them how did they become wealthy, there will be a name of a business somewhere there. So I asked myself the question, what is the name of the business that was created by President Ramaphosa? And I can't know. I don't know what is the name of the business that he created. What I do know, he was a labor, he was a trade union leader. He was that. And what I do know, there were a number of so-called empowerment deals that made him a very, very wealthy man. So did he create real wealth? Did he add to the wealth in South Africa? And I must be honest and say, no, I don't think he added something. He maybe participated in the redistribution of wealth, and he benefited from a redistribution of wealth than many other. But I can't see the wealth that he's added. If you ask me about the trillion, 100 people and R1 trillion in South Africa, I think it could be quite close to the actual mark.
We're on the subject of black economic empowerment and its failures to assist in either transforming South Africa or growing the economy. It reminds me of what perhaps the smartest person of recent generations had to say. Albert Einstein said, all knowledge comes from experience. And this is what he, as a theoretical scientist, applied to get his theory of relativity to be adopted generally. He said, in theory, this is the way it works, but we've got to test it. Until it's been tested, then there is no way that anyone can accept it. Well, it was tested, and in 1919, it got the thumbs up. But here in South Africa, we have a theory of BEE as it is currently imposed, fixing the economy, distributing wealth, bringing up people who were disadvantaged in the past. But if you're a scientist looking at it, you've got to say, hang on, this didn't fail. So let's go back to the idea, throw it out, bring in a new idea. Not if you're one of the beneficiaries or those who are enjoying the fruits of the status quo. And if the man leading the country is one of the biggest beneficiaries of all, well, what are your chances? But pressure on BEE and other issues is reaching boiling point because the country is really not succeeding. And there's a wild card in here, and that is independence of the Western Cape. It's back on the table. More people are talking about it. And here's Phil Craig, the leader of the Referendum Party and a co-founder of the Cape Independence Advocacy Group, who tells us that there's a lot of interest now in the United States for the concept of Cape independence. That could also be a game changer.
We've had a change of tack. So we negotiated a referendum. I personally agreed a referendum with John Steenhuisen, who promised that the DA would call a referendum which included a question on Cape independence. And ultimately, the DA reneged on that and that agreement. And you know, they say this, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result is insanity. We've stopped at this point in time trying to lobby the DA into calling a referendum, and we're busy organising a private referendum in either late 2026 or early 2027 is our best forecast at the moment. We are going to organise a private referendum, or a referendum of the Western Cape, which will be privately organised. Of all 3.2 million Western Cape voters, and we're going to hold our own referendum on Cape independence. If we can, you know, if we can deliver Cape independence in the Western Cape, we'll get to the point where it's supportable. The US is going to support us in a heartbeat. That's absolutely clear. I can say that unequivocally. They're not going to say that publicly. They didn't say it in as many words to me, but it's absolutely clear that we have their moral and ideological support for this. They absolutely understand the issues that are there. But what we have to realize, we obviously, whenever South Africa is in the news in the US, we hear it, we kind of think, hang on a second, all the US does is talk about South Africa. South Africa is a blip on the radar in the US. And that's the one thing that I had to learn for myself, that if you take up of the bandwidth, if South Africa takes up, you know, a quarter of 1% of the US's bandwidth, that's our reality. And we might always hear about that quarter of 1%, but they're not spending their life talking about South Africa and our problems. And the one message that I brought back really to the Cape Independence movement is, these guys will absolutely support us. Now is our time, but we've got to do the hard work. We've got it. They're not going to come and magically deliver it for us. We're going to have to do it ourselves. And if they do it ourselves, we've got a strong ally. And I've got some, you know, we developed some really strong allies behind the scenes and people who will publicly start to come out and to make noises in our favor. But we've got to create momentum here. And actually, that helped a lot. I came back. We're busy with a big unification project inside of the Cape Independence movement. The referendum party, the Cape Independence Party, Cape Exit, who've got 840,000 members, and the CIAG signed a memorandum of understanding about a month and a half ago, and we're very far down the road in terms of this combined effort that's going to resolve in this referendum being held privately. That's one of the key issues for there, and we need to create that, which then you can imagine, you know, if we're sitting here in 18 months time and we've got a referendum win which has been inspected and overseen by the international community, and we can go and say, look, the DA may be blocking an official referendum on Cape Independence, but here's the private referendum. You inspected it. You've seen it was of all 3.2 million people of the Western Cape. And we can prove beyond a shadow of doubt that the majority of people in the Western Cape favor Cape Independence. That is going to radically change the game. And that's our project. And I think on the back of that, the US will do a lot. I mean, look, ironically, there are delegations. There's a US delegation in the Western Cape at the moment, discussing specifically Cape independence, and I'm not going to give all of the details, but you know, those interactions are going on. So yes, there is definitely interest in this project at all levels of government, including the very highest in the US.
That's a heck of a statement. So there is a group of people from the United States right now in the Western Cape discussing Cape independence. Phil Craig was referring there to his five-week visit to the U.S. recently, where he met with people at very senior levels, and that is the feedback that he's brought. One of them was put together all these disparate Cape independence groupings and have a united front. The pressure's growing. It'll be interesting to see how that develops in the months ahead.
Hermanus is a man from this windy little town called Yaku. Sorry, other way around. Yaku's from Hermanus. Yaku, we need to talk about your upgrade problem.
I don't have an upgrade problem.
Two Audis, an Opel, a Kia, and a Hyundai. It's five cars, Yaku.
Denial.
I just love cars. And we buy cars that make it so much easier for you and convenient to sell your car. You want to try it?
Okay, just once. Turn off the cameras.
I see how this is addictive.
Take two of those.
We buy cars. The easiest way to sell your car by far.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
You might know that BizNews turned 12 years old earlier this month. We're very proud of the milestone that we've achieved, a dozen years old, especially when you have a look at the South African media landscape, where it's pretty difficult to get things going. Thanks to your help, we are getting stronger all the time, and our most recent project is miningweb.com. We haven't been shouting it from the rooftops. It's a slow and steady advance. But one of the constituents of it is a weekly discussion that I have with, if you like, mining's equivalent of Neil De Beer, a gent by the name of Peter Major. He's a wonderful investor. He is a corporate specialist. And, well, anything to do with mining anywhere in the world, he's your man. I spoke to him yesterday with the first episode of Mining Web Weekly. He's in Idaho at the moment, mining silver.
We know the problem. It's got three letters, huh? It starts with A and it ends with C. And that is the biggest problem with exploration in this country. It's no secret. Everybody knows it. First of all,
so for those who don't know, we're talking ANC, the socialist ruling party in South Africa.
Yeah, if it was only socialist, if it wasn't kleptomania. Anyways, kleptocracy. So let's look at exploration. You're out in your backyard, you're out on the mountain, you're exploring. And whether you plan on finding something or you accidentally find on something, you come up with a shiny rock and you get it tested, you talk to experts, and that's a valuable rock, whether it's gold, platinum, copper, doesn't matter. It costs money to do professional exploration, to find a deposit large enough to be economically viable. And we know small mines are not economically viable because they have to do so much of the same things the big mines have, but they don't have the resources, the expertise, especially nowadays, you know. ESG, community relations, health, safety, the list goes on. It costs as much for a little company to do that. The admin work, you know, the running around chasing, where's my permit? When's it going to get processed? So people don't want to explore in South Africa because even if they find something, they can't raise money to take it up the curve. They can't find somebody to sell it to. And the big companies aren't exploring here because they say, we've got 5 years left, we got 10 years left, but if the trend is your friend, we are in a horrible trend. We're in a trend where the infrastructure is getting worse and worse, where the uncertainty of legislation is getting worse, And the certainty of the legislation is bad. You know, Guedi always says, okay, I've removed uncertainty. You know, we're just going to take 51% of every diamond project. Well, you might have certainty in it, but that's not bringing in money. You know, the ANC to say diamonds are special, you have to give up 51%. Well, they changed that after a decade or so. But it just shows their policy is not well thought out. It's thought out by people that don't know what they're doing. So let's get back. That's why people are not investing in exploration. Because South Africa probably has more known minerals than any single country in the world. But yes, what you know, you sink a shaft, you build a mine, you know there's so much there. But you have to continually drill, use geophysics, explore, put people on the ground. But there's no return in that investment. So I think that simplifies your question. There's no return in investment because even if you find something, you can't find somebody to develop it with you. You can't find anybody to buy it. And it's because of the whole perception, which is a true perception, that South Africa is not an easy, stable, good place to do business with, especially in mining. There's too many kleptocrats all around mining who misjudged it by a mile, who thought a gold mine is just a hole in the ground that sends out gold bricks, like a gusher of an oil well in Texas in the old days. And they don't realize, no, a mine is a black hole. It's an enormous, giant black shaft that sucks more money than you'll ever see, that you'll ever put together. And only if it's finely balanced and managed by like a symphony conductor that Oppenheimer's and our other mining giants were. They have to manage all these different moving plates on the sticks correctly. Then it will produce money for the good of the country.
And just to put that into some kind of a context to what Peter says, mining is a wasting asset. So you find the mine, you put the your investment in, you mine, you take out of the ground the minerals. The only way that that asset will continue to be sustainable into the future is if you explore, i.e. exploration. But as he articulated there, the ANC policy on exploration is like a tourniquet. It's killing the lifeblood of this industry, which has been the backbone of South Africa's economy for decades, if not centuries. What a shame. But as mentioned earlier on, it does seem like the penny's dropping. Let's hope that Pretoria starts adopting a little bit of Albert Einstein's approach and realizes that ideas need to work, otherwise they must be abandoned or changed. We heard from William Sanderson Mayer yesterday. He is the columnist who has written or who writes Jaundiced Eye, the longest running political column in South Africa. And I asked him to give us some more insight on why he feels the country is in such a dangerous place right now. Let's join him.
There are murky things happening in the background. I think it's quite interesting that when the DA's national spokesperson on international affairs, Emma Powell, resigned, in her letter, she said South Africans have no, that in her movement, in her job through the continent, she became alarmed by the degree to which the interests within the ANC and within South African officialdom are linked to rogue figures and rogue regimes around the world. Now, that's code, I think, for links between the ANC and the Iranians, without a doubt. I can't say without doubt because it's not overtly stated, but that is what I would draw from her comments. She's bitten the dust and out she goes. The key to me is, however, whatever the ramifications and web that is spun behind what is unfolding now, we're in a dangerous moment. We are in a more dangerous moment. And what is interesting is we seem to be unaware of how dangerous the moment is. We have a general who is contradicting the president. The president says it should not have happened. I didn't know it. Now, I don't know if we can still believe our president. I mean, he lies often and quite brazenly. He's been called out by two judicial commissions, one the Zondo Commission, and second the Filer-Filer Commission, who said that the evidence that he delivered to both those commissions were at times incredible and unlikely, and they stopped short of calling him a liar, but to all intents and purposes, they called him a liar. So it's very simple possible that he's lying about this. If he is not lying, if the general has acted beyond his remit, Ramaphosa has to act. It is the survival then of our democracy in a sense, because if generals can do such things, the next general will also do it. It's not going to stop with this one performance, and it's a slippery slope. The next, we're heading the Zimbabwean route. Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't have a lot of courage. And unfortunately, the DA within the GNU has no route into DIRCA, the International Affairs Department, nor into the Ministry of Defense, nor into the state security apparatus. So all the most crucial and powerful departments within government are a closed book to the DA. So it cannot exercise a true unity role within that government because it's been excluded from the most important levers of power. And it unfortunately means it also sits on it doesn't attack as it should be. The DA should be desperately concerned about what is happening here. It's not enough to say this is unacceptable, but the general must know. They need to know why they didn't know about any of this.
Indeed. Well, it's an interesting time that we're at the moment. One of the issues that does surprise us, and I had a chat last night with Dr. Franz Cronier, who will be at the BizNews conference only in 3 weeks' time, and he said to me what frustrates him is that there's an incredible deal that could be done between South Africa and the United States. And when you consider that China's not giving us much support, Russia doesn't have the money to give us support, China has its own issues to deal with, India's got its own problems, the U.S. is the one country that really can turbocharge growth in South Africa. And yet we have this strange philosophy towards it. And I say a strange philosophy because the next story identifies how every year the Americans have got 85,000 work visas that are available for people. In other words, who want to go and skilled people from around the world who want to go and work in America. Well, your chance of getting one of those visas is 1 in 5. Because 450,000 people apply for those work visas. So there's a heck of a magnet that exists in the US. But you take it one step further, those who are now wanting desperately to get those 85,000 visas are actually gaming the system. Bloomberg, our partners, did an investigation into this and found some rather strange behavior in the so-called lottery becoming anything but. Let's have a look.
The most viable path to come work in the United States, apply for H-1B visa.
The alphabet soup of H-1B, L-1, and all manner of other foreign worker visas may seem like a simple pro versus anti-immigration issue. But looking more closely at these programs reveals a system rife with opportunities for fraud and exploitation that's badly in need of reform, and perhaps even expansion.
The H-1B program was designed to attract the best and brightest to fill high-skill jobs in the United States where domestic talent is in short supply.
Something close to 80% of the petitions are now held by Indian workers.
There's so much demand for it, the government has to run a lottery. Last year, over 450,000 people registered for the lottery for the only 85,000 slots. Starting 2023, we've been hearing from sources and people on social media complaining about the surge of lottery entrants.
Many firms are not getting the visas that they apply for.
The irony of the program is if you are a company seeking to employ a specific person with special skills, the game is stacked against you. From the very beginning, this H-1B program was heavily dominated by outsourcing and staffing companies. Like in any lottery, the way to increase your chance is to get more lottery tickets.
In 2024, USCIS cracked down on multiple registration fraud by not selecting based on unique registrations, but rather by unique individuals.
I think there is general consensus that this program is in dire need of reform.
The question at the heart of these visas is, can U.S. policymakers change this system in ways that will be more fair to workers, no matter where they're from? Or will corporate interests seek to maintain a status quo that lowers labor costs and increases their margins?
Immigrants make up the bulk of Silicon Valley's workforce, so any attempt to cut back on the program is a threat to the U.S. tech industry.
Fascinating insights there from our partners at Bloomberg. Well, here on the local front, quite a lot of news going on today from the Stock Exchange News Service. We had interim results from a coal mining group, Exxaro, solid, and the dividend was up by 6%. But on the other hand, it had to deal with a drop in the coal price. Now, what Exxaro is busy doing, it tells us, is diversifying away from coal into other areas. But coal is still very much its core business. It's had difficulties as well with Transnet Freight Rail, something else that I suppose gives miners or mining investors pause. Spur Corporation, a food group with lots of restaurants around the country and many franchises, produced some solid numbers for its financial year to the end of June. Revenue up by just over 11%, and it had a first-time contribution from Doppio Zero, which was recently acquired. Headline earnings per share up 16%, which is great in a country where your inflation's below 5, and the final dividend of 193 cents is sure to please shareholders. That was all announced on the Stock Exchange News Service today. However, shareholders can't be too happy. As you can see from the share price, they're only up by 2% in the past year, and they've got issues. Competition's increasing. And John Dory's saw sales down 5%. Modern Tailors Ambassador, another of the brands, is needing to reinvest heavily to remain competitive. There is a corporate battle that's emerged at Atterbury Property Holdings. Today, the company released a voluntary statement saying that Brian Roberts, who's the chief executive at RMB's property subsidiary, RMH Holdings, and who's been on the board of Atterbury for something like 8 years, has been voted off the board because of, quote, a strategic misalignment. This points to significant disagreements. Watch this space. And then finally, BrightRock's co-founder and chief executive, Skulk Malan, who less than two years ago said it's great to be part of Sunlum, which had then taken 100% share in the once independent company, has left. He has joined the Standard Bank Insurance and Asset Management Unit, where he will be Chief Executive of South African Insurance. Well, we close off our program today with a little bit of light relief. And here is a clip from Facebook about a quite remarkable canine.
Do you want to sing Katy Perry? Okay. I'm going to do the pre-chorus. You just come in on, baby, you're a firework. But just don't sing over my part, okay? I get the solo. You come in on the chorus with me. Ready? Ignite the light and let it shine.
Oh, man, you get some great stuff on social media nowadays, don't you? Well, this has been your Biz News Briefing. We'll be back again on Monday. Have a fabulous weekend. Kom bokke, kom reg, asseblief. Stuur hy ossies, hy's toe, with their tails between their legs. Can't lose again, please, Rassie. And look forward to being back in your company on Monday. Until then, cheerio.